Reading this morning from the Gospel according to Luke, the first chapter, verses 1 through 4. Since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed on to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, I too decided, after investigating everything carefully from the very first, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the truth concerning the things about which you have been instructed. And from Paul's letter to the Colossians, the first chapter, verses 15 to 20, we read, He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. May God bless and sanctify this reading among us today. You may be seated.
Seek the truth. That's what the trailer for the Da Vinci Code invites us to do. And that's exactly what I'm going to propose you do today as we ponder together some of the things that are taught in the Da Vinci Code, which I understand is a work of fiction, but which challenge some of the things that we believe as Christians. That's what our aim is today. We're going to be taking a look at this book, a book that's been a sensation, 46 million copies sold worldwide, now a movie out of the theaters this weekend. We're going to ponder together what are some of the things that it says about the faith that we hold, and how do we really understand these things? How do we know anything about Jesus at all? Was Jesus really married? Did he have a child, or maybe more than one child? And was Jesus simply a man, tragically killed at the age of 33, or was he something more than a man? I was riding home from Atlanta on an airplane after I was speaking there on Thursday. It was Thursday evening late, and as we were flying home, I was working on this sermon, and I turned to the person sitting next to me, and I noticed she happened to be reading the Da Vinci Code. And so So we began to chat a bit. I thought it was humorous. We started talking, and she was sharing with me her thoughts of the book. And as we were talking, the woman who was sitting in the row in front of me was eavesdropping, and she held over her seat, the Da Vinci Code, and let me know that she also was reading the Da Vinci Code. And I was surrounded. And it really is kind of typical. I wonder how many of you have read this book? Yeah, I mean, at least half of you. And even if you haven't read the book, I think what we're going to talk about today will be helpful to you. I'm appreciative that Dan Brown wrote this book. I'm a little disappointed in parts of it, but I'm appreciative that he wrote the book because it's become an opportunity for us to talk about things in churches that we should be talking about. I want you to understand certain things about the faith, and sometimes we pastors have done a lousy job of teaching you. Where does your faith come from? Where did the Bible come from? How was it decided what books would be in the Bible? And why do we believe the things that we believe? And so I want to encourage you to seek the truth. I'm confident that if you seek the truth, your faith is strong enough. Maybe not yours personally, the faith, the Christian faith, has a strong enough claim to be the truth that you can ask the hardest questions you want of it, you can do all the research that you like, and you're going to come back and go, there's a good reason for me to be a Christian. And I'm persuaded that's the case today. Now, when you read the Da Vinci Code, or if you see the movie, it really comes out more in the book, you're going to find that there are several things that are said in there. In fact, the basic premise of the book has a lot to do with the Christian faith. And what's challenging about it, you know, you say, well, it's just a work of fiction, Pastor, and I agree, just a work of fiction. But what's challenging is that it's set out as a historical fiction. Historical fictions are set in certain historical circumstances. And the foreground story is the fiction, and the background story is the history in which the novel takes place. Now, we understand how to read those things. This book seems to say that that's what it is. You get to page one, and it says fact, and it starts listing a whole series of facts. So it's leading you to believe from page one that this is a historical fiction. But when you get into the story, you find that it's, in fact, claiming that the very things that you believe as Christians are fiction, and that that's a fact. It comes out really clearly in the movie. I saw the movie on Friday. I've read the book several years ago. And in the movie, there's one line. I don't remember if it appears in the book as well. And it says this, "What happens when the world discovers that the greatest story ever told is a lie?" Well, the Christian faith is the greatest story ever told that it's referring to. What happens when the world discovers it's a lie? Now, this is, of course, entertaining. I mean, you read the book, and it's very entertaining, but I want you to be offended in the midst of being entertained. I want you to not just say, well, it's entertainment. I don't really care what I put into my mind. It doesn't matter. I want you to go, okay, I'm going to be entertained, but I'm going to be a little bit offended here, too, because this fella is calling my story that shaped my life a lie. So be a bit offended. It's okay to be offended sometimes. Now, the basic assertions we're going to deal with, you know, the art historians, I'll leave it to them to talk about whether Leonardo da Vinci was really meaning to paint the things that the Da Vinci Code says he was, and maybe some other historians to tell you more about the Priory of Sion and all these things, but What I'd like to focus on, and the area in which I feel qualified to speak, has to do with the development of the New Testament canon. That is, how did our New Testament come to be? Are there other Gospels? In fact, let me just mention the three assertions that we're going to deal with today. In the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown says that there were over 80 Gospels that were written, and perhaps one even by Jesus' own hand himself, and that the church suppressed most of those Gospels, burned them, destroyed them, because they didn't paint the picture of Jesus that the church wanted people to believe. And so the church chose four Gospels that substantiated its views of Jesus, and it destroyed all the others. There were 80 other Gospels, maybe even one that was written by Jesus himself that was suppressed by the church. So we're going to talk about that in just a moment. Then in one of those Gospels, maybe two, maybe a whole bunch of them, according to Dan Brown's ideas, there are testimonies that Jesus was actually married to Mary Magdalene, and that she conceived a child and that she was pregnant when Jesus was crucified. And that the lineage of Jesus went on long after, in fact, all the way to the present day, according to the story. Then finally, both of these are to lead us to understand that the church invented the idea of Jesus' deity or divinity. In fact, it upgraded his status, according to Brown, at the Council of Nicaea, from merely a mortal to being a divine being, a God-man. And that was a fiction, that was something created by the church. And anything that countered that viewpoint was suppressed by the church. And so these are the basic ideas. Of course, the idea that Jesus was divine and human is the doctrine of the incarnation, that God became flesh and lived among us, and that's a central tenet of the Christian faith. And everything else begins to rise out of that, the meaning of his death on the cross, the significance of his resurrection. All of these things flow from these basic, essential assertions of the Christian faith that the Da Vinci Code would suggest are falsified. So we're going to take some time to do what the Da Vinci Code invites us to do. We're going to take some time to seek the truth. Let me just begin by saying this, just as an upfront. If you came today seeking a sermon where somewhere in here you're going to laugh and sometime you're going to cry and it's going to be emotional and spiritual, you know, inspiring, please come back next week. Today what I want to do is try to teach you. And again, I thank God for this book because it gives us a chance to teach, but I'm going to give you lots of information. Now when you look at your study guide, would you take out your study guide for just a moment? Your study guide is an outline of today's message. I'd like to encourage you to follow along and take notes. I will tell you that we're going to spend most of our time, 25 minutes or so, on point one, and the other 2 points we're going to cover in about 5 minutes each. So don't get upset if 25 minutes into this, you're going, oh my gosh, he's still on point one, we're going to be here all day. No, you won't. If it were up to me, you'd be here all day. I'd love to lecture you for 4 hours on this, but we're going to cover this in the amount of time. But just know we're going to spend most of our time on point one, and out of point one will come the answers to point two and point three. On the back side, you're going to find a study guide, and this is an invitation for you to read the Bible on your own to seek the truth. And you're going to see that on one of the days, you're going to have a chance to read every New Testament scripture passage about Mary Magdalene. You're going to have a chance on other days to read what the New Testament documents say about the divinity of Christ. And so this gives you a chance to do some of your own research as you seek the truth. All right, well, let's begin with this question. How do we know anything about Jesus Christ at all? I mean, Jesus Christ lived 2,000 years ago. He lived as a peasant in a backwaters part of the Roman Empire. There were no newspapers there recording the events of his day, of his life. There were no video cameras. How do we know anything about this? How do you know anything about somebody who lived 2,000 years ago? Julius Caesar or Augustus Caesar? Or go back several hundred years before that, Homer? How do you know about these folks? Well, there's not a lot of information about most of them. In fact, there's more information from the period in which Jesus lived written about him than probably any other historical figure who has ever lived. There are 27 different documents written in the first century describing this man's life, talking about his impact on other people's lives. That's more testimony than you'll find about Augustus Caesar, Julius Caesar, or anyone else, documents from the exact time period in which this figure lived. But of course, when it comes to understanding historical figures, if you want to go back 2,000 years, part of what you ideally would like to do is you'd like to hear from those people who actually knew the person. Those people actually saw them, listened to them, heard from them. Those would be eyewitnesses. And you'd want to hear what the eyewitnesses said in sort of a biographical fashion about this person. Who were they? What did they do? What did their life mean? Then you might be willing to also listen to those who spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, this person. They had analyzed the initial information, and then they thought about it even more and said, well, this is what we think this person's life really meant, his impact on history, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's what you ideally want to do. You want to go back as close as possible to the source material and find out about this individual. Now, when it comes to the documents that we have in the New Testament, we have the earliest materials about the person of Jesus. Let's talk about how those documents were initially written. First of all, Jesus did not write anything that we know of. There is no evidence, I don't care whether you're an atheist or a Christian, there's simply no evidence out there that Jesus wrote anything. Why would he write anything? Jesus lived in a culture where only 3% of the people could read and write. Writing something was probably not his highest priority. Teaching them in an oral tradition, in a way that they could understand and remember things, that was really important to him. So when you read the Gospels and the things that Jesus teaches, you'll notice that he usually teaches in short, pithy sayings that could be easily memorized. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the meek. Very short little phrases. The Lord's Prayer, which you yourself have memorized. All of those are examples of how Jesus taught the multitude so they could remember what he had to say in an unliterate or illiterate culture. Now, Jesus also told stories. What Jesus knew was that people will remember stories. You will never find in the Gospels Jesus saying, take out your Bible and turn to Leviticus 26:3, and now I'm going to preach an expository sermon from the text. He doesn't do that. Instead, he says, let me tell you about a father who had two sons. And he tells a story. Let me tell you about a farmer who sowed some seed. So Jesus tells stories, and he hooks the meaning of the kingdom to the stories. Here's what I know as a preacher, is that most of you will not remember very much of what I say except my stories I tell you. And when you walk out the door, people come to me and say, boy, that was a great story. I really appreciated that. And sometimes I want to say, yeah, but did you hear the rest of it? But I realize, you know, as long as the story illustrates well the subject that I'm trying to address, it's okay if what you remember is the story. Hopefully it'll take you back to the meat of the message. That's what Jesus did. So almost everything he taught was either in stories or short, pithy sayings that could easily be memorized. Now, after Jesus' death and resurrection, Christians believe that Jesus rose from the dead on the third day. He ascended into heaven after spending some time with his disciples after his resurrection. After he was no longer physically present with the disciples, they had come to see several things. First of all, they had come to believe something specific about Jesus, who he was, what he came to do. They had come to be touched by him and found their lives revolutionized by his ministry. They were utterly transformed by his presence. They had come to believe that he was, that in him God had walked on this planet, and that he was alive in the throne at the throne of God today, and that they could continue to talk to Jesus. And they could have an ongoing relationship with Jesus Christ. And this also gave them power and strength. They believed that he had come to die for the sins of the world, and that in his resurrection he utterly obliterated our fear of death. So important was this man, they believed that he utterly transformed not only their lives, but could transform the entire world, if only they could tell the story. And so, in the first generation of Christians, they didn't have any written documents. What they had was their stories to tell. So the disciples go about and they tell other people. There were the 12 apostles. One of them committed suicide. One replaced him. They had been with Jesus during his entire 3-year public ministry. There were hundreds of others who had seen him resurrected from the grave. And all these people went about telling the story. And they would say things like this, I've got to tell you about my friend Jesus. These are the things that he did. And these are the things that he said. And I saw him when he was crucified. And I saw him when he was raised from the dead. And you can believe me or not believe me, but I will tell you, he changed my life and I would die for this man. And if you want to follow him with me, all you have to do is say, Jesus Christ, I want to follow you. Why don't you come and follow him? So those initial witnesses went out and they told this story. And those who heard and who believed, some didn't believe, those who did believe, they committed their lives to Jesus. They went out and they told other friends, listen, I got to tell you what my friend Peter told me about this man Jesus. I didn't meet him personally, but he told me the stories and I believe Peter because he can be trusted. And then I trusted my life to Jesus, and as I did and I began to talk to him, I felt my sins forgiven and I felt his presence in my life and I found my life turned upside down for him. Do you want to believe too? And that person might say yes. And so it was for the first 10 years of the Christian faith, is that people were telling the story. It was in the preaching of Jesus Christ that people came to know about him. It was in the stories that were told. And then they began to believe, and as they believed, they began to experience Christ's presence. So there was two ways they knew about Jesus. The first was by listening to other people tell the stories of what happened in his life, and the second was by their personal experience of Jesus himself. Look at the timeline on your sermon notes. You'll notice that Jesus, on the right-hand side of the page, you'll notice that Jesus died about AD 30. Jesus died. He was born probably about 4 BC. Our calendars are off. He lived to be about 33, and so he died about AD 30. In the first 10 years, the gospel was proclaimed orally, nothing probably written down. About AD 40, the Apostle Paul, who had been a persecutor of Christians, a Jewish rabbi, had an amazing conversion experience where he encountered the risen Christ, and his life was totally turned upside down. And he began to proclaim Christ. He spent 10 years learning about Jesus and trying to understand more about him, having not been one of Jesus' followers. He learned as much as he could, and he began to proclaim the gospel. He traveled throughout the Roman Empire, offering Christ to Jews and pagans alike. And everywhere he would travel, he would tell the stories, and then he would invite them to follow. And some would say yes, and they would begin to be followers of Jesus. And he would organize them into little churches. And as he organized them into churches, he would go then to the next town, and he would go on to preach. But he would write letters back to those churches. He would write them letters, and he would say, we call them epistles. And he would say, now here's what you should do, and here's an answer to the questions you have. And he would address the needs they had as early Christians. These were the earliest documents in your New Testament. They were written before the Gospels, the letters of Paul, at least the first letters of Paul. Paul was converted about A.D. 40. The first letter that we have of his in the New Testament dates to about A.D. 50. That's probably Galatians or maybe 1 Thessalonians. So these were written even before the Gospels. So the letters begin to be written by Paul, and he describes faith in Jesus Christ. Then we find at the end of Paul's life, after 65, when he was beheaded for his faith, the churches began to exchange their letters with one another. They would copy them, and the church at Philippi would say, hey, you Ephesians, do you want to see our letter? We'll share with you our letter. You share with us your letter. The letters of Paul began to be bound together. And so probably by 70 or 80 AD, the letters of Paul were bound together in what became the nucleus of your New Testament. So that was the first form of a New Testament, was just the letters of Paul. Now, around AD 50, the gospel started to be written. Now, it wasn't actually the Gospels. These were pre-Gospels, if you will. And here's what precipitated the writing of the Gospels, we think. Well, let me tell you a modern-day story, and this might help you understand. A week and a half ago, one of our lead custodians here at the church, Paul Palmer, passed away. And as Paul was nearing death, his son from out of town came in town, so his two twin boys were with him. And while they were there those last few days, part of what they were doing was saying, Dad, tell us your stories. Tell us about what life was like when you were a child. Tell us about the time you were in the army, in the military. Why were they asking these stories? Because they knew that pretty soon the only source of that information would be gone. They wanted to remember the stories. Now, about AD 50, the first of the disciples had already died. There were others who were getting older, others who were facing death. And the church began to realize, we better get this stuff down. We better remember these stories and remember them correctly. And people began to write these things down. They began to write down, there were some, we believe, maybe several different people who wrote down the sayings of Jesus. There were others who wrote down the miracle stories of Jesus. There were some who wrote down the stories of Jesus' death and resurrection and how they occurred. And so these are pre-Gospels, if you will, and they begin to circulate around. And this is information that's kept. Remember, most people can't read or write, so it was really being designed to make sure that the truth of the Gospel, the facts of the Gospel, were not misconstrued in the future. These things begin to be written down. Now, we think that by A.D. 65, the first Gospel was written. That was the Gospel according to Mark. Now, Mark was said to be the interpreter of the Apostle Peter in Rome. And when Peter died in Rome, when he was crucified upside down, it became important to write down his memoirs. And so very early in the history of the church, testimony was given that Mark's gospel was the memoirs of the Apostle Peter. It's the shortest of the gospels. It has the least amount of information, 16 chapters long, and it begins to give us the earliest reflections of one of the apostles about the life of Jesus. Now, by 70 to 80 A.D., The other disciples, at least two other followers of Jesus, write down gospel accounts. And that is Luke and Matthew. Luke and Matthew. And one of the things we learn from Luke's gospel in his prologue is how he came to write and why he wrote. And I want you to notice the scripture that's at the top of your sermon notes. Here we read these words from Luke as he starts to write his gospel around 70 or 80 A.D. He says, "Since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us," notice he says, many have undertaken to set down an orderly account. These are those pre-gospel materials that I was describing to you. And those began to be written down very early. Many had already done this. He says in verse 2, "Just as they were handed on to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word." So he's saying those people who wrote down those early gospel accounts, the pre-gospels, got that information from those who were eyewitnesses who had actually seen these things that Jesus did and heard what he said. He says then in verse 3, "I too decided after investigating everything carefully." This is important. Luke's telling you, I investigated everything carefully from the beginning. I went back and talked to people who had talked to people. I read the accounts I had access to. I investigated this in order to write a carefully ordered account, most excellent Theophilus. Now, Theophilus may have been a political leader, and Luke was writing the gospel specifically for this individual. The word Theophilus actually means lover of God, and it could have been written for anyone who was a lover of God. But I want you to notice verse 4. This is why he wrote the gospel. You remember, the Da Vinci Code encourages us to seek the truth. Verse 4. Luke says, "I wrote this gospel so that you may know the truth concerning the things about which you have been instructed." This was important to Luke, that you know the truth. This is the truth, he's saying. This is the gospel story. All right. Well, we do know that Matthew and Luke drew upon multiple sources. Luke tells us that. But when you study the Gospels, you've noticed this, if you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that there are places where there's almost word-for-word agreement between Matthew and Luke, places where there's word-for-word agreement between Matthew and Mark, places where there's word-for-word agreement between Mark and Luke. These three Gospels often agree, and sometimes they disagree in how they tell the story. Now, as scholars have studied this, part of what they pointed to is the fact that there were sources behind the gospel. So if the gospels were written from 65 to 75, again, they're pointing back to 80, they're pointing back towards even earlier source material closer to the time of Jesus. Now, let me just lay out something quickly for those of you who have an interest in this. When you find Matthew and Luke agreeing almost word for word on certain stories, but they are not included in Mark, that would tell you that Matthew and Luke are probably drawing upon a common source that Mark didn't have. And so you can recreate that source by finding the places where Matthew and Luke virtually agree. Now, we've called that source, scholars have called that source, very simply, source. In German, the word for source is Quelle, or Q. So if you read the Da Vinci Code and you heard about the Gospel of Q, unfortunately Dan Brown gets it wrong, nobody ever asserted that Jesus wrote the Gospel of Q. These were sayings of Jesus. Everything we find in Q, in this hypothetical source, are sayings of Jesus that Matthew and Luke share in common, almost word for word. Then we know there are places where Matthew and Mark agree perfectly, and places where Mark and Luke agree perfectly. We believe that Mark was written first, and Matthew and Luke both draw upon Mark. Then we have unique information of Matthew. We believe it was proto-Matthew, or an early version of Matthew, and there's material that Luke has that nobody else has, and that's proto-Luke. Just to get a picture of what this looks like, take a look at the diagram on the screen. And you'll see then what's called the four gospel hypothesis. And that is that Mark was written very early, maybe even an earlier version of Mark than we have. Then there's Q, which is Quella, or source, and that's sayings of Jesus that are found in Matthew and Luke, almost word for word. Then there's material in Luke's gospel that's unique to Luke, that's L, or proto-Luke. And then there's M, that's proto-Matthew, unique material to Matthew. M, Mark, Q, and L are the earliest strata of data written down about Jesus. Matthew and Luke incorporate that into their Gospels. Why am I telling you all this? I want you to understand how your Gospels came about. These weren't just spurious and people just sat down and started coming up with some good ideas. These were materials that were beginning to be written down in the earliest time of the Christian faith. There was a meaningful way of looking at and analyzing that data that Luke had and trying to put it into a form so that you might know the truth. What about all those other Gospels that Dan Brown mentions that were written? Well, he mentions 80. Scholars don't know of any more than 14, aside from the Gospels in the New Testament. If you take the four Gospels in the New Testament, the three sources behind them, M, Q, and L, you have seven sources, plus 14 Gospels that are named in antiquity, you have possibly 21 different Gospels. Now, what about those other Gospels? Well, let's talk about them for a moment. There were, of those 14 other Gospels, all but one were written in the 2nd century or maybe the early 3rd century. Most of them were written around 150. So you'll notice on your diagram, I've shared with you 30 is the time that Jesus died. 50 is when the Gospels, the proto-Gospels, began to be written. 70 is about the time that Matthew and Luke are written. Then you go all the way down to 150, and that's about the time these other Gospels begin to be written. Now there's two broad categories of alternative Gospels that are out there. The first category are things that are just fanciful. They're fun to read, but I wouldn't base much on them. And these are Gospels that are in the tradition of the Gospels we have in the New Testament, but they try to fill in the gaps. So didn't you ever wonder what Jesus' childhood was like? I mean, of course, if you ever thought about it, you wonder, well, I wonder what Jesus was like as a kid. The Gospels only have one account of Jesus when he was 12. So there's a lot of time not accounted for until the age of 30. And so the gospel writers, the folks writing gospels in the 2nd and 3rd century, began to write gospels about this. So they're fun stories, but not seemingly very historically accurate. We have one where Jesus is in the shop with his dad, Joseph, who's cut a piece of wood, and he cuts it off too short. And Jesus says, hey, Pops, don't worry about it. Let me take care of it for you. And he comes and he takes the board and he stretches it out miraculously and makes it longer. You know, that's the kind of story you find in some of these Gospels. Or we find that Jesus, in those second century Gospels, was like Superman when he was a kid. You know, he's got all these superhuman powers, but he can't control them very well. So one day he's on a rooftop with another kid, and the other kid irritates him, and Jesus pushes him, and he didn't know his own strength, and he fell off the roof, and the kid breaks his neck and dies. Jesus then runs downstairs, and he resurrects him from the dead. But after that, Jesus isn't allowed to play with the other kids anymore. At one point, he wants to impress his friends, and so he makes little clay doves, and he blows on them, and they fly away. Now, does that sound very much like the kind of gospel in the scriptures? Now, here's what I find interesting is Dan Brown says that the church suppressed all these other gospels because they were emphasizing Jesus' humanity, and the gospels in the New Testament emphasize his divinity. Well, from that statement, it's clear to me Dan Brown never read any of these other gospels because all of the other gospels point towards a more superhuman Jesus than what we find in the gospels of the New Testament. So there's this one category of gospels that are interesting reading, but they're not probably based on much historical fact. There's another category of Gospels that were written by a particular sect within the early Christian church. Now, in the first century, there was a sect of people who held to a philosophy called Gnosticism. This is even before Christianity came about. Gnostics believed that there was a spirit realm and the material realm. The material world was evil. The spirit realm was good. There were two gods, at least. There was a god of the spirit realm, and there was a god of the material realm. The goal in this life was to transcend the physical realm and enter into, live already into the spiritual realm while you were still alive, and then eventually to die and to enter into the spirit realm. There were guides from the spirit realm who would come and give wisdom and secret knowledge. The Greek word for knowledge is gnosis. They would give secret knowledge to certain people. Now, when Gnosticism met Christianity, an interesting thing happened. When Gnosticism met Christianity, the Gnostics said, "Wow, this is like our story." They heard about the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, and they said, the God of the Old Testament sounds like the God who's a bit sinister, the God of the material flesh, trapping spirit beings in the material world. The Father of Jesus sounds like the good God and the God that we believe in the spirit realm. And Jesus must be like the spirit being who comes down to help us have secret knowledge so we can live in this life and transcend this life and enter into the spirit realm. So Gnosticism takes Christianity and sort of weds it to its own philosophical ideas. It wasn't very popular. There was a very small number of Christians across the Roman Empire who embraced these ideas, and some of them were a little bit more conservative and looked a little more like biblical Christianity, and some of them were not. Many of them were in Egypt, and those who were in Egypt wrote down some of their ideas. There were probably 100 different things they wrote down. We know of 4 Gospels that they wrote, maybe more. And these Gospels mostly were lost to us. We find in ancient history the stories in Christian history of some of these things, they were mentioned. In 1945, we found some of them. They'd been lost, destroyed through the centuries. In 1945, there was a farmer who was out in his field, digging in the field, and he came across a clay jar. Now, he was hesitant to open it at first, afraid there might be an evil spirit inside, but his desire for wealth finally convinced him to open it up, and he broke it open, and he found the codices you see on the video screen in this photograph. Now, these codices, these are basically like books. They're bound together as books, leather-bound. These don't date back to the 3rd century, to the 200s, or maybe the early 300s, I don't recall. But the manuscripts in them were probably originally written around 150, and these contain these Gnostic reflections of the faith. Now, you read the Gnostic Gospels, and you find several things. First of all, when I read them, and they're available on the internet, you can read them. I even gave you a link to the Gospel of Judas not long ago. It was not in the Nag Hammadi Scriptures. It was found in the 1970s, but also a Gnostic Gospel. When you read these Gnostic Gospels, part of what you see is Jesus seems to be a bit bizarre. You can't always understand what he's saying. His teaching is very esoteric. And he appears to be a spirit being, not really a human being. And so when you read it, some of the Gnostics actually believe that Jesus never was really in the flesh. He only appeared to be a man for a period of time in order to communicate this secret knowledge. So these are the Gospels that Dan Brown is talking about in the Da Vinci Code. Far from making Jesus more human, they made him some kind of odd spirit being. And some of the teachings that he gives there, we can understand. Some of them are difficult to understand. So, nothing to be afraid of in reading. But here's the thing. When you go back and you read these Gospels, this treasure trove of Gospels, you have to ask this question. In the early church, they knew about these Gospels. Why were they not incorporated into the Scriptures? Why did this, if they knew about them, why was it that they were not embraced wholly? Now, and was that a reflection of true Christianity, and later on, the alternative Christianity really suppressed the truth? Well, here's a way to think about this. I want you to imagine that 1,800 years from now, archaeologists find a treasure trove of something called compact disks with data on them from the year 2006. And these archaeologists are interested in knowing specifically, they want to study people who lived in the central part of the United States, people who lived in what was at the time called the state of Kansas. And so they want to do some study on this. And they've got these compact disks, and they figure out how to retrieve the data from them. And now what they want to know is, one of the things they want to know is, what were the people of faith like in the state of Kansas in 2006? And so they do two things. They happen to find one set of files on here of sermons from a particular preacher. And they read those sermons. They say, oh my goodness, is this what Christianity was like in Kansas in 2006? And because they found these sermons, now they know about a whole bunch of other sermons, but these are so intriguing, they begin to think that everybody in Kansas believed what this particular preacher told. And they find substantiating data in that when they do a search of information across the United States in the year 2006, the most frequently quoted pastor in the state of Kansas across the United States was the pastor who wrote these sermons. And so they decide that all Christians in Kansas must have really held, it was the dominant form of Christianity, must have held these beliefs. The pastor's name is Fred Phelps. The church is the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas. Total membership, 30. Now, you understand how this could happen, though. You find one set of writings, you look to see who's talked about a lot, and you decide that that is the dominant form of Christianity. Of course you wouldn't do that. What you do is you'd say, what do most of the churches in Kansas talk about? What did most of the preachers preach about? And you'd say, that's probably the dominant form, and this is some kind of stray, errant form of the gospel. Well, that's the way you should look at history when you go back and analyze what happened in the second and third centuries. Yes, there were other written materials. We'll find others in the coming decades. But you ask the question, why did the early church not include this in their New Testaments? Let me give you three reasons why they didn't include them. There were three criteria as the church began to wrestle with what should be authoritative for Christian doctrine. All right, and we call this canonical. The word canon means rule or read. It was a way of talking about what was authoritative. And they said, let's figure out with all these different documents which ones are authoritative. And so there were three criteria. The first one was apostolicity. This is listed on your sermon notes. Apostolicity. That is, which of the documents, which of the various books and letters that are circulating around were actually written by apostles or by those who knew the apostles? So a criteria for being included among the authoritative scriptures is that the book had to either be written by an apostle or by someone who knew an apostle, who had actually had firsthand experience, so it could be no further than the second generation of Christianity. So this is what we find in the first criteria of canonicity. The second one was Catholicity. Catholicity, you know the word Catholic means universal. And the question was, what are the books that are nearly universally accepted by all the churches? Not what does one particular church in Africa hold to, but what do most of the churches hold to be the authoritative body of texts? And so for the first 350 years of Christianity, the church is wrestling with what books belong in the New Testament, and they look to see what did most churches accept. And so that was a second criteria. The third was orthodoxy. And they wanted to know which, if a book taught the faith as Christians had held it for as long as people could remember, if it taught that faith, it was orthodox. If it taught things that were different from that, they said, wait a second, this isn't the faith as it was handed down to us through the generations. So, for example, in 180, there was a gospel that began to circulate called the Gospel of Peter. It had been around for some time. It's a pretty good book. It wasn't too errant, but in the Gospel of Peter, it said that Jesus didn't really suffer any pain on the cross. Now, in the second century, those Gnostics were teaching that Jesus wasn't physically really a human being. He was only a spirit being. A spirit being wouldn't experience any pain on the cross. So when the church saw that, they said, wait a second, this is sort of bordering on some of that stuff that we are not holding to. Jesus was a man and was God, and of course he suffered pain. So let's set aside Peter and say, the Gospel of Peter, and say that probably isn't teaching what we heard from the very beginning. So this is how it happened. This is how those Gospels were determined. And over that 350-year period of time, the church came to conclude that the four Gospels are the primary sources of faith and practice. Now, by 150, those four Gospels were already circulating together, and by 180, the church had already agreed, this is the testimony, these are the Gospels. There was no debate about it. There was virtually no one who believes anything else should be in there. Now, I mentioned to you it took 350 years for the church to decide what went in your New Testament. Not exactly. Paul's letters were beginning to be bound together in the first century. The four Gospels, right after John was written, they began to be bound together and circulated together. By 180, it was virtual agreement upon almost everything in your New Testament. Where there was debate, the book of Revelation was debated for 350 years, whether it belonged in the New Testament or not. The book of 2 Peter, Hebrews sometimes was debated. 2 and 3 John were sometimes debated. So there were things that made it in the New Testament, and some people didn't think they should be in there. There were a handful of books that some people thought should be in there, but didn't make it. None of them were Gospels like Dan Brown talks about. The only things that were debated were things like the Shepherd of Hermas and First Clement and some other wonderful books to read, and the church decided they weren't old enough, they weren't that closely tied to an apostle, and so the church said, read these, but they don't form the basis of our doctrine in the faith. That's the process called canonization, and that's what we know as you study this. You studied, I don't care whether you're a Christian or an atheist, you're going to come to the same conclusion that this is how our New Testament was formed. It wasn't 325 AD at the Council of Nicaea where the church is trying to upgrade the status of Jesus, and so they selected certain gospels and hid the rest of them that were somehow painting a more human picture of Jesus. And if you read these other gospels, I think you'll agree, having read them, they make me appreciate so much more the gospels in our New Testament. Jesus makes sense in the gospels in our New Testament. It's hard to make sense of him in some of these other gospels. Jesus looks both human, but has indications of divinity in our gospels in the New Testament. The other gospels paint him out to be some kind of spirit being. It's hard to even sort of relate to. When I read the other gospels, it makes me grateful for the first century gospels that tell us the story of Jesus. All right, now I want to wrap the rest of this up very quickly. Was Jesus married to Mary Magdalene? Well, in one of the second century Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels, it says that Mary was a companion of Jesus. Now, Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code gets the facts wrong in terms of the language and even the word, but the word koinonos was a word that meant companion or friend or even business associate. It's not used of one who is a spouse, except in a very sort of arm's length way. It wouldn't be the word that would be used of spouse. It would be used of someone who is a companion, a friend, or a business associate. Even a disciple could be called this. There was another of the Gnostic Gospels that said that Jesus would often kiss Mary on the lips. And so this is the two bits of data that is used to say that Jesus married Mary Magdalene and had a child by him. Now, it's important for you to remember that kissing people on the lips in the first century and second century was very different than kissing them on the lips today. Do you remember that in the early church, the New Testament commands the believers to give one another a kiss? No, we have you shake hands today because we think you'd be freaked out if we asked you to kiss each other in church. We have a different understanding of what a kiss means than they had in the first century. I was speaking recently with a pastor who had been over to Russia. I've been there a couple of times. He said, you know, the thing that I just couldn't get used to was the kiss. And I said, well, what do you mean? I mean, it's not that bad. You just turn your cheek and they kiss you. No, no. When last time I was there, I was speaking and this big burly Russian pastor came up and planted a kiss right on my lips. And I said, well, you know, it's helpful if you turn your cheek quickly before they do that. But you see, in Russia, it's seen differently. They understand that differently than the way we understand it here. And I don't think that Russian pastor was wanting to marry this American pastor and have babies by him. I think he was saying, you know what? Thank you for coming to Russia and sharing your stories. I'm so appreciative of what you've done. That's how it was communicated. Now, in that Gnostic gospel, it also says that Jesus kissed James on the lips. So either Jesus is somewhat confused about his sexual identity, or he's not meaning something sexual by this. Instead, he's communicating something else. And in the Gnostic Gospels, to kiss on the lips would be to communicate secret knowledge, which gets back to the very essence of Gnosticism. So what about it? I mean, Jesus married to Mary Magdalene. Here's the thing. When we study Mary Magdalene, you need to understand the church didn't suppress the stories about Mary Magdalene. They honored Mary Magdalene. In the Gospels, of course, we do know that seven demons were cast out of her by Jesus. We don't know if that was the kind of demons we sometimes wrestle with, wounds psychologically from the past or alcoholism or something else, or if they were spiritual entities that were cast out. We just know that she was radically changed by meeting Jesus. Luke chapter 8 tells us this. And we know that she was with Jesus when he was crucified. And we know that she was one of the women weeping at the tomb, which tells us that there was a deep love that she had for Jesus. And we know that she was the first person to see Jesus raised from the dead and to believe in the resurrection. And she became the apostle to the apostles who went and told them about the resurrection, even though they didn't believe. And all four Gospels tells us that story, which puts Mary Magdalene in a position of great honor in the Gospels. But was she in love with Jesus? Did they have a love affair? Well, here's what I think. I think, first of all, I had to ask myself this question. Would it matter to me if Jesus had actually married Mary Magdalene? I mean, would I, if the gospel said that Jesus got married to Mary Magdalene and they had a child or didn't have a child, would I say, oh, well, I can't believe in Jesus as Lord and Savior because he got married to Mary Magdalene? No. If Jesus got married to Mary Magdalene, that's fine. I would change some of the ways I think, but I would say that'd be okay. The problem is that there's no shred of evidence anywhere before 1950 that tells you that Jesus might have been married to Mary Magdalene. Even close to it. Not even the Gnostics said that. Nobody ever said they were married. So if they were, all right. But there's no evidence that they were, and so let's be honest about that. But here's what I do think about Mary Magdalene. You know, when I watch Jesus Christ Superstar, I actually love that scene where Mary is singing about Jesus. I mean, had she seen her life revolutionized by Jesus, the demons cast out and set free? And then she followed Jesus and watched as he ministered and cared for people, and the way he loved them, and then she watched as he suffered and died and rose from the dead, yeah, I'm pretty sure that she would have very strong feelings for him. I'm pretty sure that she would want to give her all to Jesus, everything that she was. I can't help but think that she wouldn't be in love with him in some sense. How could you not be? I listen to her sing that song, and I find myself weeping, identifying with it. I just don't know how to love him. But was she married to him? There's no evidence that that even was remotely close to the truth. Which takes us to the last point, and that has to do with the divinity of Jesus. You know, Dan Brown would have us believe that the dark con of man was that the church made up a story about Jesus being divine. He says, I've mentioned this several times, the Council of Nicaea in 325, Emperor Constantine, officiating over this council, upgraded the status of Jesus to divine. I tried to get my status upgraded the other day at the airport from coach to first class, and I couldn't do it. But somehow, at 325 AD, the Council of Nicaea upgraded the status of Jesus to divine. Here's the thing. From the beginning, in the earliest documents we have about the Christian faith, the eyewitnesses said, when we were with him, we experienced the presence of God. That we believe he was the Son of God. And they didn't try to explain that. They didn't know how to explain it. They just said, we believe that God walked among us in this man's flesh. And we experienced his presence and saw his glory. And in his suffering and death on the cross, we learned something about God. And watching and listening to him, we learned something about God. In his resurrection, we learned something about God. I mean, listen to these things. Matthew's gospel begins, written around 70 AD. It says this, that Jesus would be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. This isn't 325 AD, this is 70 AD. In Mark's gospel, the gospel begins, the very first verse, the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. We get to Luke's gospel, he's called the Son of the Most High. We get to John's gospel, we learn that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and lived among us, full of grace and truth. When we come to Paul's epistles, we find in Colossians, this passage I have at the top here, written somewhere between 60 and 80 AD, it says this, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. At the Council of Nicaea in 325, all the bishops of the Roman Empire came together with Emperor Constantine, a newly converted Christian, presiding. And what they were voting on was how do we explain and understand specifically who Jesus was? There was a preacher who'd been defrocked in Egypt or in Africa who had said that Jesus was a creature of God, that there was God the Father, he was really God, and then he'd created the Son, and he created the Spirit, and through the Son he created all of creation, and it was the created being, the Son, who came to save us in Jesus Christ. And for that, he was defrocked by the church, who said, that's not right. But there were some who'd come to believe that that was right, and so there was a bit of a conflict in the church. And the Council of Nicaea was called together to talk about, was God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, one God, three persons, or was there God the Father, and then there was a created being, Jesus, and then another created being, the Spirit? And in the end, what the council decided on, they said, the faith, as we've heard it from the very beginning, as we find it in the testimony of the apostles, was that there is one God in three persons, and that Jesus is fully God and fully human. You can read the outcome of that creed. You don't have to go to the history books. You can read it in your hymnal on page 880. Don't turn there now, but in the future you can turn there, and you can read the Nicene Creed. Now, Dan Brown says it was a very close vote. You know how close the vote was? Of all the bishops in the world, as they were debating about, is this what the truth is about the gospel? 300 bishops to two, 300 to two, voted that this is the essence of the faith as it's been passed down to us through the generations. All right, I want to encourage you in this. We have a tendency, as not just here at Church of the Resurrection, people as Americans, we have a tendency to buy stuff just because somebody said it and put it in print. We have a tendency to buy things just because a preacher said it, or maybe because a president said it or a politician said it. Listen carefully. Just because it sounds kind of true doesn't make it true. Just because somebody in authority said it doesn't make it true. Just because it's written in a fiction book that sells 46 million copies doesn't make it true. And what you're supposed to do as people of intelligence is you're supposed to seek the truth. You're supposed to go back and say, now, what really was true? And if you can't do enough research, at least find somebody who's done the research and to really reflect upon these things. Here's what I know. When I was 14 years old, I considered myself an atheist. I began reading the Gospels, Matthew, then I read Mark, and then I read Luke. And when I got to the end of the Gospel of Luke, I read that and I said, I think this person is telling the truth about Jesus. I had to decide if I believed the witness. I said, I believe that Luke is telling the truth about Jesus. and I want to follow this man. And as a 14-year-old kid, I gave my life to Jesus Christ. And I said, Jesus, I want to follow you and live for you. The best parts of my life since that day have all had something to do with that decision to follow Jesus Christ. I have come to know him by studying history, by studying early Christian literature, by studying the scriptures. But I also know him by my experience of how he set me free and changed my life and the joy in life I find in him. When I think about God, I can't help but think about God in terms of Jesus. The things that he said, the things that he did, how he told us the first shall be last and the last shall be first and the great among you will serve the others, how he said God the Father is like a father who had two sons, how he told the stories and showed us that God loved lost people and sitting down with drunkards and prostitutes and tax collectors, how in the end he was willing to suffer and die on the cross for us so that we might be saved and delivered from our own sin, how he rose from the dead and in him God was proclaiming that there is no death that has victory over you in the end, that death is just a step into the next life. And all of this is how I see God, because of Jesus Christ. And I'm persuaded of this. If you want to find a good attack on the Christian faith, The Da Vinci Code is just really second rate. It's an interesting novel. It's fun to read. It's intriguing. I want you to be a little offended by it. I want you to be offended because it's saying that the greatest story ever told was a lie. So while you're intrigued by the story and interested in it, and it's a fun story and a nominally interesting movie, I want you to seek the truth. And I want you to know that you can stand on the truth of the gospel. And that when you seek the truth that is Jesus and you find that truth will set you free. Let's pray. God, we thank you that you care about truth, that you are truth. And we have, many of us, have enjoyed reading a novel that was a page-turning whodunit. And sometimes we just scanned right past the fact that the novel was something that turned the greatest story ever told into a lie. Help us to think about these things. Help us to be mindful of them. Help us to be able to enjoy the stories that are out there in the world, but at the same time to understand the truth and to know how to share that truth with others. Lord, help us to know that we can stand confident on the Gospels, and help us to know you. Finally, O God, as the faith was passed down from generation to generation by people bearing witness to what you've done in their lives and telling your stories in Jesus Christ, Help us to tell the stories, to bear witness to the truth. In Christ's name, amen.